Your Honor, just a little background before I get into the specifics of the brief that was filed. Shechem Lafayette, as you may or may not know, is a citizen of Jamaica, subject to deportation, and he is has an ICE detainer. He was indicted July 26, 88, arrested August 1, 88. He's been incarcerated from that date to the present and continuing. He was tried October 28, 1988, and there was a jury verdict November 9, 88. It was a general verdict, as the court well knows. He's a first-time nonviolent offender, sentenced to 410 months initially. That was subsequently raised to 470 months in 1997, subsequently reduced to 292 months August 6, 2001, and then resentenced to the same term on 27 March 2008. After the 27 March 2008 sentencing, Mr. Shechem Lafayette filed this instant appeal, and it grows out of his argument that the court failed to follow the procedures under 3582C. Specifically, Mr. Lafayette feels that the court failed to follow the two-step process. First, in giving him the two-level reduction that he felt he was entitled to, and even if the court didn't feel he was entitled to that, the court failed, of course, to properly consider and articulate the factors under 3553A before denying his request for relief. He also makes arguments that he's made before this court before. One, that the sentence that he's received is unlawful, and at the very least, it's unreasonable. If I may strike some of the points that he's raised in his brief. Mr. Lafayette contends that Section 841B1C mandates a sentence of no more than 20 years, 240 months, and as this court has already heard, he's received much in excess of that. He says he can't be sentenced to more than 20 years because the aggravating factors that were considered by the court violate Apprendi. In other words, there was no finding by the jury of any of the aggravating factors, no admission on his part of any wrongdoing regarding those aggravating factors. And he also feels...
How can it make any sense to apply Apprendi in the context of 3582C2?
Well, Mr.
It appears simply to give the judge discretion. It's all may. And then the policies which are incorporated, I guess, by reference, or at least which are alluded to in the section, underscore the discretionary character of it. That seems to take us just automatically completely out of Apprendi land.
Well, I think Mr. Lafayette's argument, Your Honor, is that even if it's discretionary on the part of the court, it still has to do a 3553A analysis, and he feels that the court failed.
I was interested in your jury argument. Putting aside
the argument.
Yeah. Putting aside the impracticality of calling together a new jury at this stage. I mean, Apprendi is based on the supposition you have a jury there finding guilt, and the question is, what does it have to find at that time? It's not a sort of ongoing rule that anything, whenever anything happens with regard to a sentence, there's got to be a jury.
Well, Your Honor, my understanding of Apprendi is that if the accused receives a sentence in excess of the statutory maximum, that those aggravating factors that resulted in that excess had to be found by a jury. Now, I'm not talking about impaneling a jury again. I'm talking about what the court has done. And what the court has done is it's found that he had a leadership role, and it also found that he had a weapons violation. The jury never found that. That wasn't even in the indictment.
Are you going back to the original sentencing?
No, I'm going back to the one that we have before us here, and that's the problem. The court never went through the 3553A factors, and I think that Mr. Lafayette's argument is that the court had to look at the nature of the offense, what his role was, et cetera, as they would have done in a new sentencing, in a brand new sentencing, and he said that never happened. And if that had happened, I think his argument is he would have been able to preserve his Apprendi argument once again and presented it to this court and a new panel.
Preserve it. Again, you're saying, if I understand you, that despite the entirely discretionary language, the language vesting discretion in the district judge, the activities that the judge pursues under 3582C2 are activities which depend on jury findings. Let's say at least anything negative to the defendant.
If it depends on jury findings.
Just not to, putting aside the inconvenience issues and so forth and other things about the context of this proceeding, that seems to have no basis in Apprendi at all.
Well, I'm not sure that I followed the court completely in the question. It seems to me that the better view would be the one that Hicks took in the Ninth Circuit. And the Hicks court said that with respect to a case like this, that the court is supposed to go through the analysis that is mandated by Booker and, I suspect, Apprendi. You say that, or the question suggests that it's discretionary, and if the court says, well, I'm not going to resentence him to a reduction or give him a reduction, that's the end of the analysis. But I think not, Your Honor. I think that the court has to
look. Any other circuit follow Hicks besides the Ninth?
No.
And
no,
the Ninth has taken that, according to the 28J letter we received, the Ninth has taken that question en banc, not another case. So. Is it correct, as far as you know, that the Ninth has taken that question en banc in a later case? No.
The government has said that I have no reason to doubt that that is, in fact, the case. And I've looked
like at. Like me, you haven't checked behind them, I guess.
But how would that help you in any event? Hicks gives the sentencing judge, the resentencing judge, more discretion, right?
Yes.
So why would that trigger an Apprendi issue?
I think the problem here, as Mr. Lafayette sees it, is that the court failed to exercise its discretion.
That's totally independent of the Apprendi claim.
Correct.
So we're now off the Apprendi claim.
Yes, we are. He doesn't want to be off the Apprendi claim, but we are.
I understand. Before you go further, the government brief said that Mr. Lafayette was scheduled to be released in January 2010, but it did not say the day, which might be relevant in terms of the mootness of the case, depending upon how speedy court is. Do you know the day?
No, I don't know the exact day, Your Honor. I'm sorry. As I said, I wasn't his trial defense counsel. And in fact, in all fairness, I need to tell the court that I represented him back in 2001 on another petition. I think he's had about seven or eight now. And at that time, it was reduced to 292 months. In any event, it's clear that the court has a grasp of what's going on here. Perhaps I should just move to the arguments that were and the cases cited by the government. They cited a number. None of them are very helpful to us, but I wanted an opportunity with some of the time that I had left to try to distinguish those, if not factually, at least to make argument as to why this court shouldn't consider those to be controlling. They start, I think, with Vautier, which is in the Eighth Circuit, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I think it's Vautier. And that was a case where a gentleman also filed a motion under 3582C, and he moved to reduce his sentence pursuant to an amendment by the Sentencing Commission, and that was Amendment 516. And like Mr. Lafayette, he was involved in an 846 conspiracy involving controlled dangerous substances. But unlike Mr. Lafayette, he was involved in crimes of violence. In fact, his brother was killed as a result of his activities. And one of the things that Mr. Lafayette has pointed out repeatedly, not only in this petition, in this motion, and in others, is that he's a first-time nonviolent offender. And the reason I mention that is because one of the things that the district court judge had said in denying or refusing Mr. Lafayette relief was he's never accepted responsibility, and second, he's a danger to the community. I think that argument goes directly or is rebutted directly by the fact that Mr. Lafayette is going to be deported after he's released. He's not an American citizen. So he doesn't pose a danger or a threat to any community in the United States. Now, you might say, well, what about the community back in Jamaica? I think that's a problem for the Jamaican authorities to be concerned with. So if the judge is denying him relief based on the fact that he hasn't accepted responsibility, and I think it's his absolute right to maintain his innocence, the second argument also fails because he's not going to continue to be a danger as Mr. Vautier was.
You're suggesting the court cannot consider his failure to take responsibility?
I'm saying that I think it's wrong.
I understand your argument that we shouldn't be able to consider that people who go to trial have gone to trial rather than pleaded guilty, but that's not the law, is it?
No, that's not the law, Your Honor, but I think that a person has the right to maintain that posture, and that's what he's done. And I understand what the law is, but still I want to make the point that he is a first-time nonviolent offender who, in his initial sentence, received 39 years. And he's now served over 20 years. And I'm a trial defense counsel. I don't do this much, and I don't know you gentlemen, but I have seen cases
downstairs. I was a trial defense counsel.
So. Okay. I've seen cases downstairs, Your Honor, where we've grabbed Colombians on fast boats who have had bales of cocaine in their boat and haven't received a sentence like this. Anyway, continuing, Moreno is another case that the government has relied on, and again, it doesn't help us. And like this case, it was a jury verdict without drug quantity, and the motion was denied. But what I would say with respect to that case is that while Booker had no constitutional implications in this case, and it was not on collateral review before the court, Mr. Lafayette has continuously filed cases and petitions with this court, and I would say that there's never been any gap in his maintaining his innocence, and in addition to maintaining his innocence, stating the unlawful nature of the sentence and the unreasonableness of the sentence. I'm familiar with Fashina. I know what the court has held here, but what I would say with respect to Fashina's holding that Booker is not retroactive and hence doesn't apply to 3582 cases, again, I would ask the court to look at the fact that although it's a procedural change, fundamental fairness and accuracy in sentencing is something that I think the court should consider in giving him the release that he seeks. Again, the Fashina case.
It arises out of fundamental fairness or accuracy, does it? It arises out of the right to jury trial.
Your Honor, you've said that before. I read Fashina as saying Booker was not retroactive.
He's talking about Apprendi.
Right, it was. But I think what we're looking at in Fashina also is whether or not it was retroactive. And I think Mr. Lafayette's argument is that Booker is retroactive or should be in his particular circumstance. And I think what he's trying to get at there is that the court had discretion not to follow or discretion to ignore the federal sentencing guidelines or see them only as guiding and not mandatory. And he said the judge didn't do that in this instance. He said the judge felt that he was compelled to sentence Mr. Lafayette the same way that he did last time. And he said that because Booker is in fact retroactive to his case, he should have received a different sentence. Now, I'm here making the argument for him. I'm not necessarily saying that this court is wrong in its prior holding. That's just what Mr. Lafayette believes. I've looked at that. That certainly doesn't help him either. And so I go back to the Hicks case. I go back to the Lawson case. And I would ask the court, based on those two cases, to remand the case back to the trial judge and give Mr. Lafayette the relief that he seeks, which is, of course, a 240-month sentence.
Thank you, counsel. You used your time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if needed.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, counsel. Hear from the government.
Good morning. Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start off with an issue the court didn't address up to this point, and that is that what appellant is referring to as his Apprendi claims are barred procedurally because he raised them in 2000 and 2001 motions, specifically referencing the Apprendi case. The district court treated those motions, ultimately denying them. Appellant took an appeal. This court in 2003 affirmed the district court rejecting the Apprendi arguments. Appellant then raised these arguments again in 2004. That's motion is Appendix B to the government's brief.
What doctrine are you invoking?
Well, that would be the law of the case. There's been a ruling on these issues previously, and either this court rejected the claims in the 2003 opinion, appellant raised them again and did not take an appeal.
In the 2003 opinion, though, it was not on the basis that Apprendi could not apply in a 3582C2, unless I'm very much mistaken.
That's correct. But
what does that have to do with it?
Well, first of all, what appellant argued in that appeal was what he is now arguing as to the drug amount, that there was no jury finding on the amount of the drugs that he held, and therefore his sentence on count four, which was his drug conspiracy conviction, would have been capped at 240 months. That's the same argument he's arguing now. He has three what he calls Apprendi arguments. One refers to the drug amount. One is whether he was a ringleader or manager with respect to his drug offenses and the firearms enhancements. All of those, he argues, he lacked a jury finding, so the court improperly enhanced his sentence under the guidelines. All of those claims were made in 2000 and were before the court. Now, the court's 2003 opinion
wasn't that pre-Booker?
It was.
Well, doesn't that affect whether that decision's any longer good law?
I don't think so, because appellant actually presaged Booker. I mean, he's making arguments on the basis of Apprendi, but Booker simply said, applied Apprendi to the context of the sentencing guidelines and said the sentencing guidelines were in it. The remedial portion of its opinion said that the sentencing guidelines are now advisory, but the arguments that appellant made in 2000 and 2001 were the same, that he was entitled to a jury finding on these issues. So law of the case doctrine does apply. And in any event, even if the court disagrees with me about the 2003 opinion, he raised these arguments in 2004 expressly. If you look at the record material B to the government's brief, he raised each of the same arguments he's raising on appeal. The district court denied him relief, and he did not appeal. And law of the case doctrine makes clear that that decision has finality. He chose not to appeal.
The change in sentencing guidelines that made possible the current proceeding was after that, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, you're saying, I think, the issue of law that he is invoking now was available to him then with respect to a completely different 3582C. Is that right?
In a sense, I think it's important to separate out the two different claims he makes three, but there are two that we're dealing with this morning. The one claim is that the court abused its discretion in its 3582 hearing by not fully considering the 3553 factors. That's predicated on the change in the guidelines, the two-level reduction for crack cocaine offenses. Appellant makes a separate set of arguments that he calls his Apprendi claims, which I've already related, and they involved whether the jury found that he was a ringleader, whether the jury found that he possessed firearms in connection with a drug trafficking offense, whether the jury found the drug amount. And he made those arguments previously, and they do not hang on the Sentencing Commission's change in its guidelines as to the crack cocaine offenses. Appellant raised those arguments repeatedly, and he can't relitigate them now. Those are two separate sorts of arguments. If the court has no further questions about the procedural bar arguments, I'd like to move on to the merits of his claim, which is that the court abused its discretion under 3553. The trial court started out in the hearing by reading from the guidelines, and what it started with was the fact that it needed to apply the 3553A factors. Not only was the court aware of that, but it did in fact apply those factors. That's found at Joint Appendix 174. The court responded to the arguments the parties raised. It listed at least two of the factors, which is all it's required to do under the law. It found evidence in the record and that the court's findings are not clearly erroneous. It found that appellant remained a public safety risk because of the seriousness of his underlying offenses, because of his prison misconduct, which included a 2004 introducing drugs into the prison. That's at Joint Appendix 90.
What do you say to the deportation argument?
Well, I think that's in many respects besides the point. First of all, I guess appellant is arguing that since he's under an order of detainer, that it's really the problem of the Jamaicans, assuming that he gets deported. And my response is, first of all, the statute says that the district court's got to apply these factors, and that is what it did. It does not, the statute doesn't make any reference about any other detainers or any other potential convictions or incarceration.
It does raise the question of to what extent he's a menace, and if something had happened to him physically that made him not a menace, that would be something to be considered, right?
Well, the statute requires the court to consider public safety, and that's what the trial court did. And appellant's argument is, well, he's under an order of detainer, but first of all, appellant didn't prove that up in the district court. That's the assertion of his counsel. Second of all, even if that we take that as being true, that he's under an order of detainer, we don't know how that proceeding is going to play out. We don't know if he's going to be released, if he's going to be deported, if he's going to be held. I'm not that familiar with immigration law. I do not assume that because he's under an order of detainer that he would continue to be incarcerated. So, you know, that's a pragmatic argument, but my chief argument is the statute requires the district court to consider public safety, and that's what it did.
Because if there are facts out there which assure the proposition that someone is not going to be a danger to public safety, the mandate to consider public safety would require considering those facts, right?
I would agree that would be relevant. And
I mean, your argument is on the facts. That the facts don't nullify the menace to public safety.
Well, it's abuse of discretion review with respect to the 3553 factors, and the district court weighed that he was aware of appellant's argument that he was under an order of a detainer and rejected that. And there were other bases for the district court's decision. Another factor that the court needed to consider and did consider was whether appellant had been rehabilitated. And appellant failed to accept responsibility for his underlying convictions and for his misconduct in prison. He continued to do that during the hearing. The transcript references are in the government's brief. The court found that the fact that he failed to accept responsibility was significant under the 3553 factors because it showed that he hadn't accepted responsibility and that therefore he had not been rehabilitated, which is one of the factors. Looking at the appellant's criminal history, at the appellant at the time of the resentencing, if there are no further questions about the application of the 3553 factors, I just wanted to mention one other point, and that is that appellant is arguing that Hicks governs or at least is authoritative, and the court should follow Hicks. As indicated in the government's 34J letter, the vast majority of courts have rejected Hicks. They've done that for some of the reasons that Judge Williams expressed earlier in today's argument, and I'm not going to belabor the points in the government's brief or in the cases that are cited in our letter, but I do want to mention the fact that Section 3482 provides a limited relief. It is discretionary. It is distinguishable from Booker, and the vast majority of courts of appeals have so held. There are no further questions. We urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Martin, do you wish rebuttal?
Just briefly, Your Honor.
Oh, you got 2 minutes.
It's not even going to take that long. I just want to respond to 2 points raised by government appellate counsel on this business about the 3553A factors having been considered and the risk to the community. The misconduct in jail, as you know, is an administrative type hearing. I don't know what the safeguards are with respect to that and both sides getting to present evidence or how that works. But I do know this. Mr. Lafayette denied the charges. This is the charges of trying to import drugs into a federal facility. My understanding is that what happened in that circumstance was that he had written to a family member to send money to another inmate for stamps. Why he can't buy the stamps at the facility, I have no clue. It turns out that this other fellow was involved in the importation of drugs, and that's how Mr. Shechem Lafayette found himself being charged with attempts to import drugs into a prison. And no drugs were ever received, by the way. In any event, in 20 years, the government cites two incidents of misconduct in an administrative setting and cites these two incidents as proof that he's somehow going to be a danger to a community once released. And I don't know, and I can't say for certain with respect to the detainer issue, but I would think that once somebody has a federal conviction for a weapons charge and drug dealing, that it's not likely that Immigration and Customs is going to allow that person to stay in the United States. With respect to the case of the law doctrine, all I can say with respect to that is that he raised the issue of, Apprendi, and I know the court doesn't want to hear about that, but he raised that at the resentencing. And the case of the law doctrine, as I understand it, Your Honor, says that this court, a court of appeals, can reverse itself on any ruling if it finds that the decision was erroneous and would result in a manifest injustice. And my sit-down comment is that I think that the sentence that Mr. Shechem Lafayette has received in this particular case is a manifest injustice. 20-plus years is more than enough time for the crime that he allegedly committed when he, in fact, is a first-time offender and a nonviolent one at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. You were appointed by the court for your role in this case, and we, the court, thank you for your assistance.
Thank you, sir.
Good day.